I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, we begin our investigation into what has been called the king of missing person cases, the disappearance of Brian Schaefer. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the Prosecutors Podcast. I am your host, Brett, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Alice.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back.
Hello, Alice. It's good to be with you again.
Brett, pleasure's all mine.
Aw, well, you know, you say that, but I think the pleasure is really mine. We can fight about this later.
We'll fight about it later. Well, it really is a pleasure talking to someone else because we are still kind of in the age of social distancing here. So
we are.
I count you as my quarantine, though.
Oh, well, I'm happy to be your quarantine buddy. We are a quarantine team together. I don't know. If I have any other dad jokes, I can throw out there. So, Alice, I've been reading a book that I was going to mention to you. It's called Gone at Midnight. It's by Jake Anderson. And it is about the disappearance and death of Lisa Lamb. So, I'm only about 20% into it, but it's pretty good. I'll let you know if he says anything that makes me doubt our conclusions, but
we are always open to new information. So
we are. This just shows it. And if anybody out there, exactly. And if anybody out there, you know, heard that podcast and is interested in learning more, this guy, he obviously did a lot of investigation. You can tell even where I'm at now. So I'm going to go ahead and recommend that book, and I'll let you know if that recommendation changes as I go along. Enjoying it so far.
Maybe we can incorporate it in a Q&A if you guys have questions about Lisa Lamb.
There you go. And maybe he'll hear our podcast and be like, I really want to be on their show. And then we can interview him. Even better.
Consider this the official invitation.
Exactly.
To interview him.
Exactly. We could totally make your career. You could sell tens of books if you just appear on our podcast. But today we have, you know, if you think Lisa Lamb is mysterious and her death, you know, spooky and unsettling, we got a case for you today.
This case just boggles my mind, Brett. I've been thinking about it for weeks and I can't make heads or tails of it still. So I'm hoping that I reach a conclusion by the end of this podcast.
Yeah, I'd like to be able to say something intelligent about this case by the end. But like you said, having thought about this case for quite some time, you have Lisa Lamb, you have Maura Murray, you have those kind of cases that are really weird and mysterious and sort of different from your run-of-the-mill case. But, you know, in those cases, I felt like the conclusions we came to were pretty good conclusions. And if nothing else, you know, we had conclusions we could defend with evidence to back it up. I don't know about this one.
Yeah. I mean, this I'm really interested what you all think listening, because it is just a head scratcher. This really is one of the biggest mysteries that I've come across.
And for those of you who don't know who Brian Schaefer is, you know, I can sum it up in really one sentence. A guy walked into a bar and he never walked out. And that's not a joke. That's the story. And it is one of those stories that has perplexed people for a really long time. It's a famous story everywhere at this point, but it's been a famous story in Ohio for a long time. You know, I know the guys over at True Crime Garage. I think this is what actually really got them started in true crime, was their fascination with this story and just the inexplicable disappearance that we're going to talk about today. I think that's probably enough teasing you. So let's just dive into it and talk a little bit about what happened. So I'm going to take you back to a Friday night, March 31st, 2006. Brian Schaefer was a medical student at The Ohio State University, OH. I should supposed to say IO at that point, Alice.
Oh, IO, what? Man, I'm going to... I have boys, I have sons, and like already they're showing a propensity for loving sports. I'm going to be, they're going to like facepalm all the time with me with regards to sports. I love sports. I should say that I was like, I was a drill team girl in high school for football games, and I'm not a stereotype. I just am a little bit spacey sometimes. I'm sorry. IO, yes.
We're trying to get her caught up. Neither one of us are Ohio State fans. I just want to make that very clear. I used to work for Ohio in some capacity, so I have a soft spot for all things Ohio, but gotta say, don't love the Buckeyes. But
but I do love Buckeye treats, because those are delicious.
Those are delicious.
Those peanut butter covered chocolates.
Yeah, just don't eat an actual Buckeye, which is poisonous. I don't know if you knew that.
I think I did know that.
Ohio State is like the only team I know of that has a seed for a mascot, but at least it's a poisonous seed, I guess. So
that's pretty daunting, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it is deadly. So I don't actually know if it's deadly. I don't know what it does to you if you eat it. I guess if you eat too many, it would be deadly. Anyway, if anybody wants to write in from Ohio and let us know all about Buckeyes, feel free. We'd love to hear about it. Just none of your, you know, Ohio State stuff.
We really are a true crime podcast.
Yes, we really are. Anyway, so Brian, you know, he's a medical student at Ohio State University. He'd gone to Ohio State for undergrad, you know, smart guy, science major, and now he's in his second year at medical school. He's 27 years old. He's just finished up midterms, and spring break is about to start. Now, Brian, he'd been going through a rough time. 3 weeks before this, his mother had passed away from a rare form of bone marrow cancer, myelodysplasia. And obviously, this was a huge blow for Brian and his family. It was one of those things where, my understanding is, she was diagnosed with this cancer, and it just didn't take long for her to pass away from it. So that'd been a rough time. He'd been struggling with that. He had recently written on his MySpace page, which, you know, sets the time frame for you, quote, "My mom was the greatest, most wonderful person in the world." So not an unusual sentiment to express, but sort of shows, you know, what he's going through and what he's dealing with. But overall, things were, you know, they were looking up. And Brian was looking to the future. He had plans to fly to Miami that coming Monday, and he was going to fly with his girlfriend, Alexis. And their friends, they had been dating for a long time. It was very clear that they were in love. And their friends suspected that Brian would propose on this trip. Now, you know, this is a part of the story that gets repeated by everyone who ever tells it. I always wonder if that's true. I dated my wife for a very long time before we got married. And basically, every time we did anything, everybody thought I was going to propose. So I essentially waited until they stopped thinking that, and that's when I proposed. So it was a surprise. That's what I like to tell her, at least, is that's why I waited so long.
We'll have to have her weigh in on this in a future podcast.
One day she's going to be a guest.
How did you really feel about this?
But as far as I know, you know, on a serious note, I don't think a ring has ever been found that was attached to this. So not that you necessarily need a ring to propose, but
I think maybe what we can take away from it is that it's a seemingly good relationship and they're doing well.
Right, exactly. And this will become important in the future of our discussion about this. So just hold on to that. But whether or not he intended to propose, there was no doubt that, you know, Alexis was his world. His email password was, and I think this is great. I don't actually know how we know this, but this is what everybody says, was Alexis Love Mary, all one word. So that's where Brian was. He just experienced a tragedy, but, you know, he was moving on with it, with his life, and he had a lot to look forward to in the future.
So on that Friday night, Brian planned to hit the bars and go drinking. His dad thought he looked tired because he'd been studying. He had exams, but Brian just, he was committed to going out that night, whether to blow off steam or whatnot.
And, you know, I've been there, so, and I'm sure you have too, Alice. Like, you probably are tired. You spent all this time studying, but when it's over, I mean, you talk about a burst of energy and adrenaline. You know, I can't remember taking finals and ever just, you know, going to sleep that night. I always go out and at least celebrate a little bit when they're finished.
Yeah, no, same here. Absolutely. And so after dinner that night, Brian met up with his friend, Clint Florence. They were going to a bar crawl to celebrate the beginning of spring break. And so their plan was to take a shot at each bar before moving on to the next bar, hence the bar crawl. Have you ever done a bar crawl?
You know, I have. And this is sort of an interesting question because you always kind of come back to just how much had he had to drink that night. And when you think about a bar crawl, you're thinking, man, if they're taking a shot at every bar, that's a lot of shots. But I've been on a couple bar crawls, and I got to tell you, we never really made it past maybe the second bar. Like, you know, you do the first one and you're all like into it, and then you go to the second one and you're just kind of like, ah, let's just stay here. So,
right. It's kind of like caroling with drinking.
Yeah.
Like, if you find a place, it's like something to do, and it's like the pretense for which to go out. And it's another way to make going to bars more fun, to call it a bar crawl.
Right.
But essentially, it's just to go out with friends.
Right.
So that doesn't stick out to me in any way. Like, you know, bar crawl before spring break. It may or may not have been a lot of bars. It may or may not have been a lot of shots.
Right.
But around midnight, Clint's friend Meredith joins them. So they head over to the Ugly Tuna Saluna, which is just a great name for a bar. And this is a bar that Brian and Clint had gone to earlier in the night. So they're going back to it. This bar had a live band that night. Performing was Rock House. And it was getting close to closing time. And they were wrapping up their set. Brian tells Meredith and Clint that he's going to go talk to the band. This isn't that out of the ordinary. Brian's a friendly guy. He played the guitar. He loved Pearl Jam. And so, you know, they didn't think anything of it that he wanted to go talk to the band. But as the bar began to close, they can't find Brian anywhere. Meredith tries to call him on his cell phone, but the call goes straight to voicemail. And assuming that he'd pulled an Irish goodbye, Clint and Meredith left the bar without Brian, and they never saw Brian again.
Yeah. yeah, and to give you sort of, and we're going to go over the timeline in detail. Brian goes over to talk to the band at around 2 o'clock in the morning. And I guess in Columbus, it's the same as where I went to college. At 2 o'clock, that's when the bars really start to close down. So it's one of the situations where it's a crowded bar. They're all there together. They're all planning to leave together. But, you know, he sort of disappears. It's the end of the night. I'm sure what's happening, if you've ever been at a bar at closing time, the lights are going up. The bouncers are starting to, like, basically force everybody to leave. And I think they just thought, well, whatever. We'll hook up with him later. And they go ahead and leave. And if you've never heard this story, you know, I know what you must be thinking. Brian couldn't have just disappeared from a crowded bar, never to be seen again. But that's exactly what happened. And it's even weirder than that. So the Ugly Tuna Saluna has an escalator entrance. And I don't know if you've ever been to a bar like this. There's one in Washington in Chinatown where the bowling alley is, if you've ever been there. And, you know, you take the escalator up and it sort of dumps you out in front of the bar. And that's your entrance and that's your exit. And that's the way it was here. This is the only public entrance. It's the only pubs. It's the only public exit out of the building. So the police, you know, they're thinking, well, you know, Brian must have left through this entrance. So they pull the video because there is a video camera that's on this escalator. So they watch it and they find video of Brian and Meredith and Clint coming up the escalator as they arrive at the Ugly Tuna Saluna. So then they watch the exit. And they see a video of Brian exiting. This is about 1 o'clock around there. He actually walks out and he talks to a couple girls who were sort of standing on the landing. They have a brief conversation and then he goes back in the bar. After that, the police see video of Meredith and Clint leaving the bar along with everyone else who had been there that night. And they actually assigned a detective. And his job, and apparently this took, you know, who knows how long, a couple days, maybe a week, where he watched this video and he was able to identify everyone who came into the bar and match them with someone who left. And there was no discrepancy. So there's no extra person coming in. There's no extra person leaving. The only person who can't be accounted for is Brian. At no point after he re-enters the bar, after talking to those girls, is he seen on that video. So the police thought, well, you know, maybe he left through an emergency exit or an employee exit. But all of those exits were supposedly covered by cameras as well. And when the police reviewed that footage, none of that video showed Brian leaving either. So the other issue is you might think, well, you know, people always say, you know, that these exits are covered by cameras, but maybe something got written over or maybe there was a glitch and he slipped out. Well, the weird thing about this is the entire area around this bar is covered by closed circuit security cameras. There's a great Narratively article that talks about this. We're going to put it on the website. You should check it out. It goes into a lot of detail about all this, but I'm going to quote from it because I thought this was a really great quote. It says, still, security cameras from nearby bars, the Sloppy Donkey, which is another great name, Mad Mex, Lucky's Stout House, would have caught him when he fled the building. Somehow, he evaded surveillance in a city with more closed-circuit television than Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Toledo combined. Brian had disappeared in Ohio's most watched metropolis, where it's always 1984.
That whole part just boggles my mind. I mean, they watch these videos repeatedly.
Right.
And the whole, you know, potentially having a video written over seems unlikely because it's not like they went back weeks later to look at these the closed circuit cameras. They knew he was missing by the next morning. And so they immediately knew to look at the videos.
And I think there is one of the exits that the video would be written over after a certain amount of time. But I think you're absolutely right. I think even that video, they were able to watch and in before it was written over and did not see Brian.
So the police launches a massive search to find Brian. They cover the Ugly Tuna Saluna and they scour every inch of it. They search trash cans, dumpsters in the alleys around the bar, you know, thinking maybe Brian was either mugged or dumped in one of them or crawled into one of them after a drunken night. The Grove City landfill was searched in case Brian had ended up in the back of a dump truck because of, you know, being in one of the dumpsters. The police were able to determine where the trash would have been deposited, but despite excavations and search dogs and intense searching, they couldn't find a single thing that led them to Brian. The police dredged the river and searched its banks. I mean, they went to really incredible measures. They searched the sewer system. They brought in cadaver and search dogs to go all over the campus and the city. Now, with these dogs, they were able to make tentative hits in the alleyway leading from the bar to a Wendy's and a construction site next to the bar, but nothing definitive and nothing that led to finding Brian. Now, we've talked about cadaver and search dogs before. Tentative hits could mean anything. These are dogs. They can only alert, and there are false alerts sometimes, but also they can't tell you what they're alerting to. And so when they're saying tentative hits, we don't really know what that means because these dogs can't talk. But what we do know is even if they were able to alert, it didn't lead to anything that ultimately uncovered where Brian went. What makes this all harder is that it had rained since Brian went missing, and it's unclear if the rain had maybe confused the dogs or washed away some of his scents. And to this day, the police have no clues, no leads, and absolutely no idea what happened to Brian. It's as if he've simply vanished into thin air.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, this is an amazing case because
we've given you every piece of information.
Yeah, that's basically it.
He walks into a bar. We weren't kidding. I mean, to circle back, a man walks into a bar and never walks out.
Yeah, and then just vanishes. I mean, you know, with Maura Murray, you talk about the disappearance. Number one, she disappears in not the middle of nowhere, but pretty close to it, you know? And even with that case, you have some people who see her doing some things that you can sort of, you know, that those things happened immediately before she disappeared. You know, she got in a car wreck. She talked to Butch Atwood. She got out of her car and she was looking in the trunk. You know, you have the police dog, which has kind of a hit a little bit down the road, which makes you think, well, maybe she headed that way. You just don't have that here. You know, the best you've got are these dogs. And basically, nobody actually thinks those hits are all that significant. Even the handlers of the dogs themselves, you know, they don't, you know, I don't know exactly what a tentative hit is. I don't know if that means the dog kind of hit on it, but wasn't fully committed. And then you've got the rain and all these other factors. And while it would make sense for Brian, you know, to head down to Wendy's and get a bite after a night of drinking, you just don't actually have anything concrete about this. And, you know, you think about all those surveillance cameras, both, you know, inside the bar and outside of it. And it's just hard to wrap your mind around how this could happen in the middle of Columbus, Ohio. You know, Columbus is not a small town. It's not a huge town. It's not New York City or anything, but it's not the middle of nowhere.
And it's a going out town because it's, you know, there's a college there. And so right. There's a lot of people around.
This is the Friday after midterms.
Right, before spring break.
The first Friday of spring break. Yeah. It must have been packed that night with people.
And you know, we'll talk more about this, but of course, you're limited in how much you can tell about someone's impairment on a closed circuit camera, but Brian doesn't look particularly drunk. It's not like he's slumped over, unconscious, throwing up, or any of those sorts of things. You know, so to say that he was excessively drunk, but even if you're really drunk, you probably show up on some camera somewhere. In fact, if you're super drunk, it's probably hard not to make a scene when you go somewhere.
Right. And I think it's pretty much everybody who's talked about this says that Brian did not seem all that intoxicated. You know, the girls he talked to outside the bar have been identified, obviously have Meredith and Clint. We'll talk about them a little bit more later. And then you had the video. And like you said, you know, how drunk is he? You know, it's a combination of alcohol and being tired, which we've talked about before, and the impact that can have. From what we know, Brian wasn't, you know, stumbling, falling down, drunk. So let's back up for a second. Let's talk about this timeline and give you sort of an idea of, you know, what we're looking at. So it's March 31st. That afternoon, you know, Brian goes out to dinner with his dad. We talked about this. They went to the Outback Steakhouse. His dad, as we said earlier, he thought Brian looked tired. He told Brian he didn't think he should go out that night. You know, he should rest. He has this big trip coming up, but you know, Brian's committed. He wants to celebrate. He wants to celebrate the end of the midterms. He wants to get ready for spring break. He'd invited his brother Derek to come along, but Derek was actually doing something with his girlfriend that night, and so he couldn't go out with Brian. Alexis, his girlfriend, she was actually in Toledo spending some time with her family that night, so he couldn't go out with her either. But he did, at 6:21 that night, send a message to Alexis on her MySpace page saying how much he was looking forward to their trip to Miami. So that's at 6:21. At 9:30, Brian and his friend Clint go to the Ugly Tuna Saluna as part of this bar crawl. At 9:56, Brian calls Alexis on the phone. He told her he was out with the guys, and this was, you know, his chance to talk to her before the party really got started. He told her that he loved her, and, you know, everything seemed fine. He was going to hang out with Clint, who was a former roommate of his. Clint, they had an interesting relationship. Apparently, they had not spoken a lot the last few months. They had sort of drifted apart. People have looked at Brian's cell phone records, and the last time he had called Clint was actually St. Patrick's Day. So I don't know if they were just drinking buddies at this part or at this point or what. But in any event, they're going on this bar crawl. After the call, they go to what's called the Arena District in Columbus. They go to the North Shore Tavern. They go to a bar called Brothers. And that's where they met up with Meredith. And Meredith is really good friends with Clint. It seems like maybe they were more than friends. Clint and Meredith were supposed to house sit a professor's home that weekend. So they were going to go out, and then those two were planning to go back to this professor's home. In any event, you know, they go to the Ugly Tuna Saluna. It seems like they go to these two other bars. If that's all they went to, we're doing the one shot at each bar. That's only three drinks. And Meredith is going to give them a ride back to the Ugly Tuna, because I guess that's where, you know, they liked best. So at 1:15 a.m., you see the security footage of Brian, Clint, and Meredith riding up the escalator to the Ugly Tuna Saluna. At 1:55 a.m., you see Brian again. He's talking to two women outside the bar, but still in the building and not down the escalator. You know, from the footage, he doesn't appear to be that drunk. He's not faltering. He's not stumbling. And the two women have said, you know, he seemed fine. He then walks off camera towards the entrance to the Ugly Tuna. You can't see him go back in, but he doesn't go down the escalator. And no one really disputes that what he did was go back into the bar. And after he went back, there's nowhere else to go. And you would really have to believe that both Clint and Meredith are lying at this point, because they then see him again. He comes back into the bar. He finds them. At some point just after this, he says, "Hey, I'm going to go talk to the band," which is called Rock House. That was the name of the band. Now, this is the thing he does. He's a big Pearl Jam fan. He has a tattoo on his shoulder, or actually on his like upper arm, which is the stick figure from their debut album. And this is what he's into. You know, he's told people that, you know, he's going to be a doctor, but his real dream, being a band, which I totally get. So he tells them, "Hey, I'm going to talk to the band." And you can imagine this is the time to do it, because it's around 2. The bar is going to close soon. The band has finished its set.
They're probably packing up.
They're packing up, exactly. So Brian is going to go over there. Well, he goes, and he doesn't come back. And so the two friends are waiting. The bar begins to close. It's time to leave. So they start calling him. They text him. the calls go straight to voicemail. They can't get a hold of him. So we know, for instance, that Meredith called him at 2:01 a.m., and that was one of the calls that went straight to voicemail. So she left a message asking where he was, and she said, you know, her and Clint had to go. At 2:09 a.m., they are caught on camera actually leaving the garage where they had parked the car. So they leave, they go down the escalator, they walk to the garage to get the car, and they're gone. And so that's 8 minutes after this phone call. So they were house sitting, you know, and they figured, hey, we'll go do our thing, and then we'll hook up with Brian tomorrow, assuming he was just going to make his own way home. And apparently, this was not unusual for Brian. It wasn't weird for him to kind of bail at the end of the night, which I get usually. I don't know why I do this. I don't like to say goodbye.
Well, especially if your friends that you came with are planning on leaving together and going the same place.
Yeah, you know, that's like, a good point. That's a good point.
It's he fine. May think, like, yeah, you guys go. I'm going to, you know, do my own thing.
Yeah, and he may not. I mean, like I said, I don't know what the actual relationship was with Clint and Meredith. I mean, maybe it was a romance. Maybe they were good friends. Maybe it was a blossoming romance. Maybe he thought, hey, you know, they're going to, you know, house sit this house. This could be an opportunity for them to kind of, you know, hook up or whatever. I don't want to interfere. I'll just bounce, right? I mean, you totally could see that. And I've definitely done that, you know. Anybody who's ever played wingman knows there's a point where you have to, you know, you have to fly solo. So I don't know if that's what he was doing or if it was just an Irish goodbye where, you know, he was just like, I'm ready to go. And like I said, I do that all the time. If I go out with people.
It's like the only way I say goodbye is Irish goodbyes.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you just don't want to go through the whole process and everybody's been drinking. So everybody's kind of whatever. And you know, you'll see them later. So you just head out and, I could imagine that's what he does, or at least that's what they think he does. But then, as we've said, the next day comes, no Brian. Alexis is calling him, no answer. Eventually, his father heads over to his apartment. His car is parked there, and his apartment is in perfect order. The bed's made, nothing's in disarray, and it looks like that Brian just never came home.
So there is some weirdness that we want to discuss. So his girlfriend, Brian's girlfriend, Alexis, had this ritual after he had disappeared of calling his cell phone every night. This isn't that uncommon. You hear of people texting someone they, you know, someone who's passed away or calling and leaving voicemails kind of just as a connection, even though they know the person's probably not on the other end. And for months, she did this, and for months, it just went straight to voicemail, kind of like that night when Meredith tried to call him at 2:01 a.m., went straight to voicemail. But 6 months after Brian had disappeared, Alexis did her nightly call, and this time the phone rang. She wrote on her MySpace page, "It scared the crap out of me. I had no idea what I would say if a person answered it." Now, the police were able to trace the ping from Brian's cell phone to a tower in Hilliard, which is a suburb about 14 miles northwest of Columbus. That was the only time it pinged. You know, was this a computer glitch? Was Brian alive with his cell phone? Or did someone else have his phone, maybe someone who had killed Brian? And maybe the person made a mistake of turning the phone on, and it just happened to be the time in which Alexis was calling and the phone was able to ping off of a cell phone tower.
I mean, the weird thing about this, people obviously talk about this a lot related to this case, but I've never got what I felt like was a good answer on this. I can understand a computer glitch making it seem as though, you know, you're going to have a connection with a phone and it rings, but it's really not ringing anywhere except, you know, in the computer's brain or whatever. And I get that. The ping, though, I mean, wouldn't the ping have to come from his actual phone? Like, why would there be a ping? I can see her cell phone.
I don't understand pinging. The computer glitch. Yeah. I think you need the device because the whole way it's pinged is like the antenna from the phone or internal antenna of the phone, right?
That's what I thought. And like I said, I mean, if I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, the search warrants we do.
Tower. That's how you triangulate.
Yeah.
You know, these calls when we try to find a person or a cell phone.
Exactly. Like when we're doing search warrants, the whole reason we want the ping is because we're identifying where your cell phone is, not the person who's calling you. So I don't really understand. I mean, I guess the, you know, you could say the ping itself was a glitch, but when you have the combination of her calling and that's when the ping happens, I don't see how, I just don't see how that's not Brian's cell phone.
I think it was a ping. Now, I don't know how, like, I don't know if it was Brian with the phone or someone else with the phone. But I think the phone was trying. Here's the thing. 6 months later, the phone would have had to be charged probably even if it were turned off because it may have been able to hold a charge for that long. But you know, 6 months is a long time. I've kept something off for that long and you have to charge it before it'll turn back on.
I mean, I guess a computer glitch, if that means a turned off cell phone that still has some very minimal charge somehow was able to briefly connect with her phone when she called. I mean, if that's what they mean by computer glitch, that's one thing. But I don't, yeah, I just don't, I guess what we're saying, and I think what we're both saying is it seems like the phone had to do this. Like it had to be the phone, Brian's phone, making this ping. And if that's true, then you would think that's pretty significant. Whatever the basis is of that, it means his phone, at least, if not him, is close enough to ping that tower, right?
Which means the phone is not at the bottom of a river or damaged.
Right, exactly. And it's not in, you know, Tahiti either.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's close by.
Yeah, and like I said, that's one of those where, you know, we've looked to try and get a little bit more information on this. And there's all these sort of vague things, you know, where people say, well, I talked to my friend who works for the phone company and he explained this is completely a computer glitch and it's completely irrelevant. But I mean, personally, I would like to hear from somebody with a little bit more credibility than that, like the actual person who works at the cell phone company or an investigator who's looked into this. But I just haven't seen it. And you know, I think it's one of those things that people have dismissed. They sort of just hand waved it away. You know, kind of like people do, keep going back to Maura Murray, but I think these are similar cases. Kind of like people do with the cigarette, you know, everybody has basically just said, there is no cigarette. That was just cell phone light, and they move on. Well, there are really good reasons to do that in that case, but I don't know that I'm convinced that there's nothing to this ping in this case. So that's one area that I would like to know a little bit more about.
Yeah, I don't think this can be discarded.
So another weird thing or thing that people say is weird, and I can't decide actually whether it's weird or not, is Clint and the polygraph. So, you know, one thing that always happens in an investigation like this is the police will attempt to very quickly eliminate people as suspects. They do that a couple different ways. They can do it through alibis. When they can't really do that, say the instance of the last few people who saw someone alive, what they'll often do is they'll do polygraphs. And really the purpose of the polygraph is to exclude someone. You know, if you murder somebody and you can pass that first polygraph, you're probably golden because the police are probably going to move on from you at least until they find any evidence connecting you. So they do that in this case. They polygraph his father, who passes, obviously. They polygraph Meredith, and she also passes. So then they ask Clint to take a polygraph, and he refuses. And this has been a source of suspicion and controversy ever since. Brian's brother has been interviewed about this, and he said, you know, I'll quote him. He said, look, I didn't know Clint very well, but I always thought something was off with him. Now, is that true? Or is that kind of, you know, looking back with what he knows now? I don't know. Anyways, The way he talked about my brother after he went missing, kind of in a negative way, I wouldn't expect that from someone whose friend vanished. And this is something that comes up a lot as well, that Clint had apparently said, it's never clear what he said, that he had said some negative things about Brian after he disappeared. And this has gotten nasty. I mean, this is a nasty dispute. So Clint's lawyer, Anil Rosenberg, who actually is the person who advised Clint not to take a polygraph, because Clint hired him soon after this happened. He says that the police think Brian is alive. In April 2009, The Lantern, which is Ohio State's student newspaper, disclosed an exchange between Rosenberg and the family's private investigator. And Rosenberg said, quote, "If Brian is alive, which is what I'm led to believe after speaking with the detective involved, then it is Brian and not Clint who is causing his family pain and hardship. Brian should come forward and end this." Which is pissed off a lot of people that he would say that. In any event, look, Clint hasn't taken a polygraph. So the question arises, is that suspicious? Now, I'm interested to hear what Alice thinks about this. I will tell you, I am convinced that I would fail a polygraph on any subject.
Do you want to explain how a polygraph works? Polygraph doesn't actually read your brain to be able to tell if you're lying. It looks at metrics such as like your heart rate, is it heart rate? Maybe temperature, something like that. But it's looking at biometrics.
It's heart rate, skin temperature, breathing. It's like all these things that.
Right.
Right.
Biometrics that indicate you're nervous or under stress. And you know what's stressful? Taking a polygraph test or talking about someone who you are with in their last moments before they vanish from the face of the planet.
Right.
And that's why people say that people who say they can pass a polygraph, that's what they're talking about. They're somehow able to control these biometrics that would otherwise give someone away. So if you're able to control your heart rate, you know, make yourself completely serene, meditate so your brain is blank, you may be able to evade detection from a polygraph test.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there are countermeasures. You know, if you make yourself nervous beforehand, what they do is they take these control questions. So they do things like ask you your name, ask you where you were born, ask you your parents' names. And the whole point of that is to establish a baseline for your heart rate, baseline for your breathing, your temperature, skin, like all these things that they're looking at. And the idea is if you deviate from that baseline, that's when you're lying. So what they think is, well, if you're just nervous, you'll be nervous for the baseline questions too. So there shouldn't be any difference between your nerves when you're answering the pertinent questions. And there are ways to avoid this. And one way you do it is you sort of make yourself more nervous when you're answering those first questions. So the baseline is higher. And that way, when you do lie, you have less of a physical response. So I have seen polygraphs demonstrated. You know, we should note, I think everybody knows this, but there are very few jurisdictions, at least in the United States, where polygraphs are admissible as evidence. I don't think that's universally true around the world. One thing where polygraphs are routinely used is if you become a CIA agent or an FBI agent, a lot of times you will have to take and pass a polygraph to keep your job. And there's a lot of controversy about that because people will occasionally fail a polygraph and say, look, I wasn't lying, but I had all these negative consequences and there's no real science behind this. I had a friend, I think it's kind of weird. I had a friend once who applied for the CIA, and back then, at least, and I don't know if this is still true, if you had ever smoked marijuana, you couldn't get a job at the CIA. And so this person actually asked the polygraph person what he should do because he had smoked marijuana before. And the polygraph person, and I can't believe they said this, and I don't know if they reported this afterwards to whoever, but they told him, well, if you think you can lie about it, you might as well try and lie, because if you admit it, you're automatically out. Goodness. Oh, God. So there you go. The CIA at work. But
wow, what a story.
Yeah. And then I had another friend who took a polygraph, who actually was another CIA guy. And he took a polygraph. And one of the questions was if he had ever done anything illegal. And he said, yes. And the polygraph person was really surprised because nobody ever admits that. And it turns out he was talking about like downloading songs off the internet illegally. And I was like, dude, what were you thinking?
Why did you say that? Yeah.
Why did you say that? So, of course, he didn't get the job.
By five. Oh, man. Well, I mean, so, you know, I thought that was a really interesting point you said that Clint was advised by his attorney to refuse the test. I think that says something. It's not just Clint refusing to take the polygraph test, but it's actually by advice of his counsel. Now, why would he do that? You know, there's an attorney-client relationship there. Clint's attorney probably knows things that maybe have nothing to do with this case at all. And his advice comes from knowing things that only he knows because of this special relationship. By the way, you guys have probably heard of attorney-client privilege. It's a very, you know, it's quite protected. And the reason is we want people to be able to seek out counsel. And in order to get good, real counsel, you have to be able to tell your lawyer everything. There are some, you know, exceptions to this, but it's possible that there's something else Clint doesn't want to divulge. Maybe it has nothing to do with his disappearance. Maybe the two of them had hooked up with some girls that night and he was going to get nervous about that in this polygraph test because, you know, Brian has a girlfriend. Maybe Clint had a girlfriend at this point. We don't know, as we've already said.
Maybe they took some drugs.
Maybe they took some drugs. You know, Brian's in med school. You don't want to be known to be taking drugs. You know, maybe they did something that has absolutely nothing to do with this case, but it's enough that as a personal matter, Clint was nervous about testifying. So there's just so much speculation as to why you would decline or refuse to take a polygraph test. And, you know, again, like what you said, Brett, I think it's pretty important that typically we can't use polygraph tests in court. Because they're for many reasons, but as a legal mechanism, we just really can't put much weight into it. So even though it's an easy thing and it's like a very Hollywood thing to be able to point to a polygraph test and say, "Oh my goodness, you lied or you didn't lie," it's really not that simple when it comes to the weight of the evidence.
You know, if I were his lawyer, I think basically no matter what he told me, I would advise him not to take the polygraph.
Why is that?
Because the police believe polygraphs. You know, they really do. I knew a guy who was a polygraph administrator or once, and he demonstrated it on somebody. It was really interesting. And his position on it was, look, it may not be admissible, but it works. I mean, that he was 100%. If you fail a polygraph, in his view, you're lying. If you pass it, you're telling the truth. Now, I think he is way too much faith in that, but that's kind of the way the police look at them. And so if you're the lawyer and you don't necessarily feel that way, you know, you tell your client, look, I know you want to help, but if you fail this polygraph, the police are going to think you had something to do with this from now until the end of time. I think I would advise him not to take it. Now, you know, you got the thing that gets people, and I think that bothers people. If your best friend went missing, wouldn't you do everything you could to help, including taking a polygraph? I mean, wouldn't you tell your lawyer, look, if this will help find him, I'm taking it, you know?
But I don't know that they're really best friends.
I don't either. And that's the thing.
You know, it's kind of, and that's the thing is like, dang it, I was at the wrong place at the wrong time. This is someone I like just go to bars with on special occasions.
Right.
And this had to happen the night we go out.
Right. You know, and that's sort of what has snowballed. Well, if they weren't really best friends and if they hadn't been close up to this point, maybe the reason he doesn't want to do the polygraph is because he does have something to hide. And it's more than just, you know, he was cheating on Meredith with a girl in the back room, or Brian was going to hook up with somebody while Alexis was out of town, or they smoked some pot before they went to the the bar. You know, maybe it was he killed him and stuffed his body, you know, in a empty beer keg or something. and so Clint is the focus of a lot of suspicion.
And part of the reason he's the focus is, as we've already recounted to you, there's not much to focus on. We have nothing.
Yeah.
You know, that's partly why I think he's the focus.
Yeah. And we're doing two episodes on Brian. And our second episode is going to be theories. And that episode might be like 10 minutes long because this case is remarkable for how little evidence there is.
And we've talked about, you know, you just kind of threw away, well, what if Clint murdered him? We said this in our very first episode. Crimes are messy. This is not only not messy, there's just nothing.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
It's amazing how nothing there is.
Yeah, how just nothing there is. And when we talk about the theories, I think the things we have to keep in mind, and the most important things to keep in mind, are Brian's state of mind and how there's no evidence. Because I'm hoping we can sort of work our way backward from the fact there's no evidence to come to what is a guess, but is hopefully at least a plausible guess to what we think happened. And I haven't talked to Alice yet to find out what her theory is. We always kind of, we like to surprise each other.
We try to keep it exciting and fresh.
So I'm interested to know what her theory is. But, you know, like everyone, I'm going to have to wait until tomorrow, until next time, to learn that. But Alice, I hope you're taking care of yourself and staying safe and staying healthy. I feel like, I know I've said this before, but I feel like we're kind of edging towards a return to, if not normalcy, at least some semblance of it.
The dance towards normalcy.
Exactly. Soon. So, you know, one day we're going to be able to say we're doing this. We're back to doing it in the same room. But I guess we'll have to wait until some time in the future to do that.
Well, it's been a pleasure as always, and I'm really looking forward to the next episode about theories.
I am too, and I hope everybody will join us. As always, you know, shoot us an email if you know anything or if you have any questions or comments. prosecutorspod@gmail.com, @prosecutorspod for Instagram and Twitter. I guess eventually we'll get on Facebook, but we haven't done that yet. And then check out our website, prosecutorspodcast.com. And, you know, if you're downloading this from somewhere where you can leave a review if you like the show. If you don't like the show, don't leave a review.
We're not telling you what to do.
We're totally telling you what to do.
We're all about transparency here.
Yes. Transparency for those who like the show.
That's right.
But, all right, until next time, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors.
Walked into a bar.
Yeah. Okay.